All right, Daniel chapter 11. Again, remind you, as we finished last week, I want to remind you that we're still in that historical time. It won't be till the end of this chapter we'll really actually move to prophetic thing. All of it is prophetic to Daniel. When I say historical, I mean from our perspective. I don't mean from Daniel's perspective, because all of it is prophetic for him. Matter of fact, he has taken us in the prophecy that God has given us. He has taken us into that interbiblical period. And he will take us as close as, well, depending on, specifically, he'll take us as close as about 150 years before Jesus comes. And some will say he'll take you a little bit closer, because he will reference Rome in this. So let's look at this. The passage we're at, verse 24. And I think we finished verse 24 last week, and he's talking about, verse 24 really speaks of the nature of this vile person. Now, again, this man is named is Antiochus Epiphanes, okay? He is of the line of Syria, the Syrians, okay? He is from the north. He is the line of the kings of the north. And the reference mostly in here is his battle between him and the kings of the south, which would be Egypt for our preferences, okay? So again, remember the four generals of Alexander split up, took different regions and stuff. Now, when they meet in battle, the way it is, they're going to meet in battle, or they're at least going to cross over where? Well, if one's in Syria and one's in Egypt, guess what sets right in between Syria and Egypt? Still today it does. And that's Israel. And he will call it either the pleasant land, or he'll call it the glorious land. That's how Daniel saw. By the way, I remind you that Daniel, once he was taken in captivity as a teenage boy, he never got to see Israel or Jerusalem again. He never did. So, except in prophetic visions. Prophetic. God revealing the future. He gets to see it that way. And by the way, when he gets to see it now, it's not a very pleasant view that he gets, because of Antioch's Epiphanes and what he does. So verse 25, going to talk to him, talk about this conflict. This conflict continues, and he says, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. So Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of the north, will come against the king of the south, the Ptolemy group, and he will come with a great army, it says. And it says, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. So you're going to have these two mighty armies that are going to come together in conflict, in battle. Now, remember, we talked about how this got to, you remember Bernice and all the issues with the supposed marriage of convenience. It was more like a treaty marriage. You know, you marry my daughter and we'll have peace. But you'll remember that Bernice went up there. She was poisoned. And the king who married her took his wife back, because he got rid of her to marry Bernice. So, you know, and then he was poisoned by his wife. And then you have all this conflict continue going on with all that. It sounds like an ancient Peyton place taking place there. So, you know, the daily soap operas have nothing on this group. So he goes on to say that with a great mighty army, these two are going to meet together, and he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So in other words, the king of the south will not prevail, is what he's saying. They will fail to stand against them. Okay? Verse 26 says, yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. So who is going to destroy him? There's a coup. Anybody have any idea what a coup is? You live in one. So a coup is those who have authority, or those who have, you can, how does a coup work? A coup never works from the outside. It always works from the inside. And it always works with trusted people who have the power and the ability to misuse that power and that ability to usurp the legitimate authority. That's a coup, just by definition. And so what is happening here is that this king of Egypt, he has people in his courts and things who do not like him for one reason or another, and they actually kill him. So that's what it says here. It says here, yes, those who eat the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. Who ate at the king's table? Not just anybody ate at the king's table. So you can see, you know, by the way, this happens a little bit later in history. Most of you know it. You know it called the Ides of March with the Romans. And when Caesar gets aerated. some people got that. Some people didn't. Okay. So here we go. So his army shall be swept away. So now, what's going to happen to his army? Well, what would happen if you took out the commander in chief in such a way? You would have an ineffective army. Would it be swept away by the enemy? Quite likely. But it also could dissolve because these people had allegiances to this king, and all of a sudden there's a coup taking place. And who do you follow? And that's the reality of what was going on at this time. So the army pretty well swept away, and many shall fall down and be slain. So many of them will die because there's no leadership. Okay, they can't stand up against Antiochus and his armies from the Syrian region. Okay, verse 27 said, both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. One of the things, that little phrase, they shall speak lies at the same table. It just simply means that that their nature has become unreliable liars. You ever know anybody, and I'm not asking you to name names now, but you ever know anybody that their nature seems to be they're liars?
Yeah.
No. If they speak, you know they're lying because their lips are moving. Because it basically is, and I've known people, even as a pastor, and even people who have served in the church, that when they open their mouth and begin to speak, what they spoke, and they had very little, it seemed that they had very little realization that they were actually lying. It was just who they were.
And that's true.
And when you try to call them on it, they, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. You know, it was their nature. Now, what's real important here, and this brings it to a matter of discernment within the body of Christ as we bring this forward a little bit, is that we need to remember that Jesus is the way, the truth. Okay, so that anything that flows out of a relationship with Jesus would always have its basis in truth. Now flip that coin, if you will, and you find that Satan is called the father of lies.
Right.
And you remember that Jesus even chastised the Pharisees one time, said, "You are a liar just like your father." So it's one of the discernment thing. If you have to wonder or have some discernment, if someone cannot speak truth, they cannot be being led by the Holy Spirit. It's just not possible.
Right. That's right.
It's just not possible. That's not to say that a Christian cannot lie, because all of you have lied, right? And if you tell me no, then I'm going to call you a liar and say you just did right now. So... It's not just a matter of one who might speak falsely, which we all have. We have to confess that. Mm-hmm. But if it becomes their nature, if it becomes what flows out of their mouth all the time, that would tell you who's behind it,
mm-hmm,
or who they belong to. You know, yeah, you're going to follow your father. You see what I'm saying? You're going to follow one who's in control of your heart and your life and your spirit. And we don't like to say that, but you know, sometimes we don't want to deal with things because it's so obvious. We have to stand up and deal with them. So he says here, both these kings shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper. And you can almost get the picture. It's not just a matter of lying that he speaks of here. It's also a matter of boasting. That's why the next phrase, and it shall not prosper. So you have these kings, who are these kings that he's talking about? Well, he's talking about the king of the south and king of the north. We know the king of the north is still Antiochus Epiphanes. The king of the south, the question is whether it's the one that has been deposed that he's referring to here or the one who replaces him. I lean toward it's the one who replaces him. Okay? Either way, the point that Daniel's trying to say here as he gets this overall picture for us is these two evil kings, one from the north and one from the south, everything they plan will not come to pass. Now, by the way, let me just say this so you understand. That does not mean that there will not be a what we might call a brief portion of history where it seems like they're prospering, where it seems like they're overcoming, where it seems like they're winning. Be careful, because, you know, evil seems that way. And to me, it always seems that way. It always seems like evil's winning, you know. And we want to say, God, why? Why, you know, and again, I remind you that we're a part of this big jigsaw puzzle that God has. And sometimes we only get to see that one piece. We don't get to see the whole thing put together, you know. The day's going to come when we will exist in the whole thing put together. Now, what's it going to be like before we get there? I couldn't tell you that, you know. And so that's kind of what I'm sure these Jewish people in the glorious land that were in the middle of this conflict were saying, God, why? Because every time one of these kings run over us, they do something evil. Okay, so that's the picture that is given here. So it, again, refers to their and it reveals that their This whole verse speaks of you know, a covenant between two liars. It sounds like negotiation in every generation.
Right.
How many remember in the old? Always funny when Laban. You remember Laban and Jacob,
yeah.
And they had this place called Mizpah. Remember that Mizpah? Anybody? It's in the book of Genesis, and it says. It's like this little blessing, may the Lord be between me and thee while we're apart from each other. Now, a lot of boyfriend and girlfriends bought these Mizpah necklaces and their hearts with the verse kind of cut in half. And when they come together, they're supposed to put them together, and it's Mizpah. And I'm sitting there shaking my head. Someone has marketed this thing of may the Lord be between me and thee. I'm thinking, a marketed an agreement between two scoundrels. And use it for a romance thing.
Yes.
You know, it's funny how we do that kind of thing. And that's what he's saying. These, they're sitting there lying to each other. They have no desire for, you know, a common bond, a confederation together and stuff. And they're just as deceptive as they could be, you know. And it seems like, I'll just tell you from my perspective, it's hard for me to believe a lot of things that I read today, that I hear today. I don't care where it comes from, because the truth is, no more do I even know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I know the scriptures. I'm gonna stick in the scripture.
Yep.
But I don't. How do you trust anything nowadays? You ever get the feeling you're being manipulated? Your emotions, your intellect, everything being manipulated. I have that's a strong feeling I have that's happening. The deception is great today. And it speaks to me of what Jesus said. It said, even when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith here on this earth? And then there's a statement that says, even the elect, if it were possible, will be deceived.
Right.
So we want to stay, guys, we want to stay on course. Be careful. I'm not saying don't listen. Listen to whoever you think is saying, but can I put it, take a lot of what you're getting from the secular world, I don't care what the source is, with a huge grain of salt.
That's right.
So, there's only one who's trustworthy.
That's right.
There's only one who's completely honest. So, we see these kings, we see and the prophecy that Daniel's given, the overall prophecy is, Daniel, they will not prosper. What they're planning will not come to fullness. Matter of fact, the point of this is, the days of these kings are already numbered. The days of the four kings that come from Alexander, the days of the Greek Empire is already numbered. That's what he's saying. Okay? So now verse 28, he says, while returning to his land with great riches, speaking of the king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. Well, who has a holy covenant? Well, Israel does. What is the what is the physical, or I don't want to say spiritual, but what is the physical manifestation of that? Well, for Israel, it would be the temple. Now, this is the second temple. This is Zerubbabel's temple, which eventually is redone by a man by the name of Herod the Great. So the temple that was there in Jesus' day was the second temple, started as Zerubbabel's temple. He came after Nehemiah and rebuilt the temple, okay? Redone by this master builder who built a lot of Jerusalem, built the temple in Jesus' time, Herod the Great, okay? That's the temple we're talking about. Solomon's temple, remember, has been destroyed, and now it has been rebuilt. This temple, obviously, will be destroyed in AD 70 by the Romans. Okay, so there is no temple, and some of you have been there. You've stood on temple, what we call Temple Mound. There's no temple. There's not, like as Jesus prophesied, there's not even one stone upon another. And some people say, well, what about the Western Wall? The Western Wall is a retaining wall for the Temple Mound. It's not the temple. Okay. Pardon me? Originally, it was a man by the name of Zerubbabel. And then when Herod the Great came along, he made it into the magnificent, like he did much of Jerusalem at that time, edifice that was there when Jesus was there. By the way, I remind you guys that we have no indication after the destruction of the first temple and Ezekiel receives a vision from God before it's destroyed, we have no biblical statement ever again that the Shekinah or the Spirit of God ever dwelt in the temple again. Okay. Which would answer some issues that we have, because during the interbiblical period that we're in right now, not only do we have the secular history going on, we have the religious history of Israel going on. Things changed. A new religion in Judaism was developed. It was a mysticism, and it's called Kabbalahism. And Kabbalahism, some people practice it even today. Other things that changed. The establishment of the Sanhedrin. There was no Sanhedrin in the Old Testament. Other things that changed. The group called the Pharisees and the group called the Sadducees. They did not exist in the Old Testament. What else changed? Well, you have the Herods who became the kings of Israel, who had no right to the throne. The Herods were not of the line of David. But not only do we have the perversion of the throne for Israel, we have the perversion of the priesthood in Israel. And by the time you get to Jesus, you have Caiaphas and Annas, who neither one were of the tribe of Levi, and neither one were of the line of Aaron. Thank you. Shouldn't have been high priest at all. Everything was corrupted. So by the time Jesus comes on the scene with the temple, everything's corrupted. The monarchy's corrupted. Corrupted? The Herods should not be there. They bought the throne pretty much. Okay? And they come under Rome. They come under power under Rome. Okay? And then the same thing with the high priest, the Sanhedrin, and which included the Pharisees and the Sadducees. All of those were established in the interbiblical period. Now Paul warns when he comes along, remember when he warns in the verse where he says worshiping of angels and stuff like that? He warns against that. Where does he get that? Well, he gets a lot of that from that Kabbalahism that I talked to you about, that Jewish mysticism which was established in the interbiblical period, where they did worship angels and things like that. That's his reference. It's not an Old Testament reference. It's not really a New Testament reference as much as it is that interbiblical period. So a lot of things will change between the Old Testament and the New Testament. You know, there were not synagogues in the Old Testament. They didn't exist. That's a New Testament thing. An interbiblical thing. So that's where we're moving toward. And so in verse 28, it says that Antiochus here, in verse 28, he finishes his battle, if you will, with the king of the south. And now he's going to head back to the north. As he's heading back to the north, where does he stop?
Jerusalem.
He stops in Jerusalem. Okay. And it's interesting. It says, and his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. Well, who moved his heart? Well, some would say God moved his heart because it was part of God's plan. Others would say his heart was moved by Satan. His heart was moved clearly, let me put it this way, clearly against God's people. That's indisputable. Okay? So it says his heart was moved against the covenant. I'm not sure that I believe that that God moved his heart against God's own covenant. So against the covenant, and so he shall do damage and return to his own land. Well, what is the damage that he would do? Well, Jesus refers to it, and it's referred later on in this book too. The damage is that he went in Antioch's Epiphany, history now, and it's not only secular history, it is Jewish history. Everybody needs to turn off their, hang on, I'll turn it off. It's easier if I do it.
Such control.
Okay, everybody's muted now. Okay, so I was saying it's not only secular history, it is Jewish history now that we're dealing with, in the sense that Antiochus went into the temple and he defiled the temple. He put a statue of his god Zeus in the temple, and then he did the worst possible thing he could do in the temple. He slaughtered a pig.
Wow.
In the temple. Now, the thing that he did, you'll remember, if you'll remember, this is not just, let me portray this for you. How did the Jews offer their sacrifices? Well, they offered their sacrifices not in the temple itself, right? But out on the altar outside the temple proper. There was a proper place for them. They didn't slaughter animals. To slaughter an animal would be an unclean thing. So the Jews did not slaughter animals in the temple. They slaughtered the animals, the offerings, at the proper place outside the temple on the altar that was prepared specifically for that. Once a year, they would take the blood of that lamb that was offered. Once a year, on the Day of Atonement, they would take a little bit of that blood, and the high priest alone would go into the temple proper. Now, you had the Holy of Holies and you had the Holy Place, which made up the temple proper. The Holy Place, only those sons of Aaron who had been assigned to take care of that, you know, they had different furniture in there and they had the showbread and different things, only they could go into that area, okay? Into the Holy of Holies, only the high priest could go in that. Remember the curtain that was there? Only the high priest could go in there, and he could only go in there once a year. He couldn't just walk into the Holy of Holies. Once a year when God allowed him to do that. And he would have to be properly attired. He would have to be properly cleansed. Ceremonial washings would have to take place. He would have to confess his own sins. He'd have to be prepared. And even with that, they would tie a rope around his ankle, because if he went in there and he was not ready to meet God, he would meet God. And they would, you know, what they said. Then they put little bells in the hem. And they said, if the bell stopped ringing, you start pulling. You know, because you're going to pull out a corpse. So that was kind of the ceremonial thing that was going on there. So Antiochus, though, you need to understand what he did. It wasn't just that he went up on the Temple Mount and slaughtered a pig, as bad as that would have been. He literally went into the temple proper, into the Holy of Holies, and slaughtered a pig. Now, some people will say, well, wait a minute. Well, if he went into the Holy of Holies, wouldn't he have died? So now we deal with the theological understanding that I believe happened, is that when the Shekinah left, when God showed Ezekiel that the Shekinah left the Holy of Holies, everything changed. It turned into a building. It was still God's building. It was still God's temple. But the Shekinah did not dwell there. If he did, Caiaphas and Annas could not have gone into the Holy of Holies, even annually. So we had everything was corrupt by that time. And the ultimate corruption, or the ultimate thing that led to the corruption of the temple, was the corrupt nature of God's own people. You see, they'd already corrupted the whole system. And now God has allowed this, if you will, to go full bore. An idol in the Holy of Holies? Not only an idol in the Holy of Holies, but a pig slaughtered in the Holy of Holies? You know, that is what Jesus refers to in Matthew chapter 24 as the abomination which causes desolation. Okay? Everybody get the picture of what's going on here. It's a horrible thing. Now we look at verse 29. It says, at the appointed time he shall return to go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. So this is the third time is what he's saying he's going to go, but he says it's not going to be the same. He's not, Antiochus Epiphany is not going to have the same, right? Something's happening. The geopolitical landscape is changing. What is changing? Well, he tells you in the next verse, for the ships of Cyprus, or some of your verses will say Chittim. Who is he referring to? He is referring to the ships that are coming from the west. Guess who he's referring to? Rome. We have the establishment of Rome here that are going to come. These ships from Cyrus or Chittim, okay, or Kittim, depends on what, again, simply means, that term means western lands. So what is a great power that comes from the west that will stop the Greek Empire and particularly will stop Antiochus Epiphanes on this thing? And the answer is Rome. Which again is fulfillment all the way back to the beginning of Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar has the vision, which comes now in his vision, in Nebuchadnezzar's vision of that multi-metallic image. We're now moving in the prophetic word of Daniel, now moving to the legs of iron. Okay? Now we're not going to stay there. He's giving us like this overall picture right now. He'll go back and fill in some of the slots and stuff, but I just want you to see that Daniel's prophecy goes all the way to the fulfillment of up to that place of the feet of iron and clay mix. But it actually goes further because at the end of this chapter, he's gonna jump to that time. So it's interesting to me that what God chose to give Nebuchadnezzar through the image of the multi-metallic image, okay, vision of that. And then also Daniel between the dreams of, about the different beasts that would be there, finishing with this indescribable beast, okay. Everything that God gave him at the beginning of his ministry, think about it this way, now God is going to show him how that is fulfilled. He'll never see it, of course, but he's going to get to do this. Now again, who ultimately comes along and fills in, particularly the details of that last the iron and clay mix feet or that last indescribable beast? And the answer is John does in the book of Revelation. Okay, questions or comments there? So yeah, go ahead, Catherine.
Last week I had asked the question: who was the first leader? Who was the first Emperor of Rome?
Yes.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, I did a little bit of Googling.
I love that.
Okay. So, the city of Rome was founded in 753 BC. The city-state, it was called the city-state, and it was ruled by seven kings. Now, the seven kings, it started with Romulus and it ended with Tarquinius, and that was in 509 BC.
Okay.
Now, later, Rome became a republic.
Which would be more this time. I think that's Caesar calling you.
Was claimed by Augustus. Caesar Augustus, and he was actually the first emperor of Rome. And this, Augustus led Rome's transformation from the Republic to the Empire, and that was around 63 BC.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. So, where are we at in that time thing? We're about 170 BC. The Antiochus Epiphanes thing. Okay, so that kind of gives you about where we're at. So about 100 years after that, we have Caesar Augustus coming and really establishing Rome as we know it. Rome as a world power and stuff. So, okay, thank you for sharing that. Okay, so we are, so the prophecy again, he jumps ahead and he tells us what's going to happen, who's going to stop him, and the answer is the next kingdom that's coming will be Rome. As we've already found out, okay? And so it says here in verse 30, for the ships of Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he stopped. What's he do? Well, he's going to try to take out his rage on the weakness, what he sees as the weakest. That's what he says here. You're going to come against the pleasant land or the holy covenant again. It says, so he shall return and show regard to those who forsake the holy covenant. So, covenant. Now, there's a little phrase there. Show regard. He'll show regard for those who forsook the holy covenant. You know what he's talking about here? He's talking about treason. He's talking about those who welcomed him and who either he bought off or who were there to subvert anything that was happening in Israel. He's referring to some of the first Judases we see. By the way, I was reading J. Vernon McGee, and he said there's always been Judases, guys. There's always been a Judas. Sometimes there's been more than one. But even at this time, there were those who were supposedly part of the covenant people who had sold themselves out. There's nothing new under the sun. It's always been people who are willing to sell themselves out and to commit treason against the very nation or the people that they are meant to either serve or protect. It's always been there.
Still is.
Well, of course, that's what I'm saying. We ought not to be surprised that it's all around us today. You know, sometimes I wish, although I don't know if I could handle it, sometimes I wish, though, that God would just pull back the veil. Lord, show me their treasonous hearts. I want to know which ones are. You know, I want to know which ones, you know, and do I believe that they're in some of the highest places in our country? I certainly do.
We probably couldn't handle it.
No. No. What would we do with the information if we had it? You know, it's kind of hard to know. You know, I have people sending me, a lot of my veteran friends send me stuff all the time. Are you ready? I said, what are you going to do, man? Who are you going to fight? How are you going to identify the enemy?
Yeah.
You know, it's not as easy as, you know, you put on your blue jersey, I'll put on my red jersey, and we'll go at it. It's just not going to be that easy. All right, so, and that's the insidious nature of traitors people.
Yep.
Because they're inside.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not easily identified. That's even why our own country dealt so harshly in the past with those who were convicted of treason.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? They were put to death. It was not a small thing. It has become a small thing. It's no big deal anymore. So, here we see this. So, that's going to happen. Once he's stopped by the Roman Navy, basically, is what he says here. The Roman Navy stops him from going down to the south to attack Egypt. In his anger, he goes back to Jerusalem. He joins with those who he knows have sold themselves out to him, you know, for freedom, safety, whatever reason people do stuff like that, power, who knows, okay? And then it says in verse 31, it says, and the forces or the arms shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there an abomination of desolation. There you have that terminology used there. Okay? By the way, it is foretold that Antichrist will come. He will allow them to reestablish the sacrificial system. But halfway through that 7-year period, he will cease the sacrifices. Just like this. Okay? And he will once again stand in the temple. This time he will, Antichrist will stand in the temple and he will declare himself to be God. An abomination of desolation. And when Jesus says, when you see that, Matthew chapter 24, when you see that, that was in reference to the end of days, and he warns them, when you see that, get out of Jerusalem. I remind you, every reference in Matthew chapter 24 is in Israel. So he's talking to them, when you see that, why didn't he say to the church, when you see that? I believe because the church won't see that. We're going to be raptured out of here. Okay? But he says, when you see that, then you flee to this place that God, a place of safety that God has. Many people believe Petra or somewhere like that, but I don't know about that, but could be. But he says, you flee. And he says, just pray that it doesn't happen in winter and pray that you're not carrying a child and all these things because, you know, when you flee and stuff. Now, some people want you to believe that the abomination of desolation happened in AD 70 when the temple was destroyed again by the Romans, that they did that. That is not true. There is no reference in history or the Bible. I'm going to tell you, if the abomination of desolation would have happened in AD 70, we would have it in the New Testament text. It would be there. We're talking about a prophetic event that Jesus himself referenced. Don't you believe that one of the apostles or one of the writers of the New Testament, I have people tell me, well, it happened in AD 70. I have people telling me that Jesus came back in AD 70. I said, really? Jesus came back in AD 70? My goodness, how can you believe such tripe as that? If Jesus came back in AD 70, don't you think not only our Bible would have it in it, but all of our religious books from the first century would just be filled with it? Jesus has already come back. It's just nuts to believe that kind of stuff. It's not theologically correct. It's not historically correct. And it does great harm to the warnings that Jesus chose to give us a warning. Particularly to give, I would say in Matthew chapter 24, to give Israel a warning. When you see these things happen, you flee. You flee from Jerusalem. Okay? So he makes it very clear. He's talking about, and he says, when you see the abomination of desolation, he's very specific. The abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. He certainly couldn't have been saying, there in about AD 33 or AD 32, whatever that was, to his disciples, you know what? Think back 170 years from here, and when you see it, well, how are they going to see that which already was? That's not what he's referring to. He's referring to something in the future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and Jesus, it was Jesus who chose in his own verbiage to reference the abomination of desolation. You have the abomination of desolation here. I've already described for you what it is. Sue.
So that's the slaughter of the pig and the Zeus.
Yes.
I thought that was up in 20.
Well, I referenced it early. I spoke of it early. But it is quite likely that he did things. We know of three trips that Antiochus made through there. It's quite likely because he was building a confederacy. We talk about these traitors and stuff like that. He was doing different things. The ultimate one that I refer to a little bit early. It's right here in verse 31. Everybody got that online too? That's really when the big one happened. But I believe before that he was in the temple. I believe he was doing stuff. I believe they were giving him access and stuff. But because by the time he does it, he knows how horrible it is. Okay? Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. It's so much there. He did go through three times. That's what you need to understand. It's in the third time that he did the ultimate that I described for you earlier. Okay? Any other question or comment? I tell you, and I say this, and I understand people don't all agree with me. I know there are other pastors that don't, other Bible teachers don't agree with me. And they're brothers and sisters in Christ, I'm okay with that. I'm okay if someone doesn't agree with me, as long as they can tell me why they don't agree biblically. But I tell you again, as the ones that I'm teaching right now, one of the reasons I am a pre-mill, pre-trib believer is the book of Daniel. And I was certain, I admit I was raised that way, but I was raised, before I started studying it myself, I just, well, that's what my pastor said. So going in there and stuff, and I understand there are always difficult passages that lead someone one way or another. Joan, please.
So where do you say that he's talking to, you think he's talking to Israel when he's talking about flee the city?
Yes.
So the Jews of that day who would have read this?
Or the ones of the future, I'm not sure. Yeah. The problem... Right, right. But again, I would remind you that every reference there is to Jerusalem. So if he's talking about a future event, the next question is, did that future event ever happen? Is there any... I could buy into... There is a fleeing that takes place, there's no doubt about it. In AD 70, there is a fleeing that takes place, and there's this awful thing that happened. I still believe it's a precursor. The problem with that is... Not everything that Jesus said happened in AD 70. So we have to, that's what I'm dealing with. And I deal with it, I do not dispute that there could be, like so many prophecies in the Old Testament, there could be an initial fulfillment with the ultimate fulfillment coming. The problem with saying that it happened there, then you must also believe that, first of all, that Revelation has an early writing date, and that everything that John talks about in Revelation has already happened. And that would be difficult.
So
go ahead.
Matthew 24, I'm thinking that he's speaking to, they ask the question, like, what are the signs, what are we going to see? And he says, and when you see this, flee.
Right.
And he's talking to his disciples who are believers.
Right.
And if you're pre-trib, they're not there. So then if he's speaking to Israel or the Jewish people...
Or the remnant that will come...
Or the remnant...
Who will have the text too. The issue is, for me, again, what is the initial question?
Right.
The initial question is, what are the signs of the end of time and what are the signs of your coming? That's the initial question. So that puts the answer into context. So once again, I say... That's why some preterists, that group called preterists, believe that Jesus had to come in AD 70. It's coming because it answers the question for them. The problem is, there's no evidence, nor is there any documentation or anything that's written after AD 70 that even speaks of Jesus coming again.
I don't think the whole AD 70 thing is happening. I'm just trying to put my head around who's going to be reading
Yeah.
this.
And that could be answered by the 144,000, and those who come to faith because of the 144,000.
But then that would have already happened.
Yes.
What would have already happened?
The abomination of desolation.
No, it actually happens halfway through, and the 144,000 are established at the beginning of the tribulation period.
Which is my case for
mid-trib. I get that. You're still premillennial, but you're holding the mid-trib, and I get that. That's why I say, and there's another group that's very close to mid-trib that's called the pre-wrath. I get their view, too. And I guess I have more problem with all millennialism and preterism and stuff like that. I really believe I can make a case as a premillennialist. So there's a difference between millennialism and tribulation understanding. I believe I can make a legitimate case as a premillennialist for pre-trib, mid-trib, pre-wrath. The hardest one in that thing would be post-trib.
Yeah.
That would be the hardest one. And not very many people hold that view at all anyways. So, yeah, I agree. I'm going to tell you as your pastor, I don't have a huge amount of problems with someone who's mid-trib. I don't have problems. People are going to believe what they're going to believe, but... For my theological people who are, that's why I've told you before, if it doesn't happen at the beginning and we're still here, I'm not a false prophet. I'm just teaching you what I think the preponderance of the scripture says. And I do think it's important, particularly when we talk about the millennial issue, more than the tribulation issue. But I appreciate that.
Kind of
And there are many premillennials that are mid-trib that hold exactly your view that says that reference helps them see it that way. I'm not going to argue with that. I would not argue with that.
Yeah. This is going to be happening, and he's saying Christians need to flee.
Right, and part of the thing I say for Matthew chapter 24 is that as you read that, as we read it, as believers, there's going to be a place in there somewhere where you're going to say, "I think the rapture happens here," because Jesus gives no answer, nor is it even. If you think about it, it's not even inferred. Read chapter 24 of Matthew. The rapture is not even inferred. Nor does he differentiate between a seven-year tribulation. That's not his point. His point is not the seven-year tribulation. His point is what's going to happen overall. It's an overall picture of what's going to happen prior to his coming and the end of time. That's the question. So there's a lot of us teachers and preachers and theologians that, from our view, say, well, rapture must happen here. We just throw it in there. I'm just here to tell you, it's not in there. It's not in there. So, again, some of the inferences and stuff would say, I think this shows it could be more to our mid-trib. I got no problem with that, guys. My major view is a millennial view issue. It is not so much a trip. If we're going to be here through half the tribulation, I believe God will give us what we need during that time and stuff. I personally don't believe we will be, but that's what I share with you.
Well, let me, here, we'll go ahead. Still have you over for dinner.
Okay, I still come over to dinner. Okay. Thank you, Dave.
If I may, the millennial question is this. I see the wisdom of your statement in saying it's very important to be right about the millennial issue because, for example, it's not real popular these days, post-millennialism, but
no.
Amillennialism is. But that would then, if I was a young person and I believed that there was no 1,000-year reign of Christ and that there was a period of future utopia, so to speak, I might really, really, really believe in the UN and the power of government to make this a better world. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, and you understand the difference here. Premillennial believes that Jesus is going to come back. Every premillennial, whenever they believe the rapture is going to happen, every premillennial believes that Jesus is coming back to this earth and he's going to establish a literal kingdom on this earth for 1,000 years. Every premillennial holds that view. Okay? Now you move into the amillennial, the prefix all before millennial, all means no or none. So an amillennialist believes that there is no 1,000 years of Christ. Now, do they believe that Jesus is going to return? Yes, they do. Some of them. Because some of them in the it's just like any other camp. Some in the all-millennials camp are what we call preterists. They believe everything prophetically that we're reading has already happened, including the second return. And I always say to my preterist acquaintances, I said, what are we doing here? And then when an all-millennialist tells me, this is heaven on earth, I say, I'm not sure I want to go to heaven in heaven, you know. So, I mean, there's theological implications. And they would say, to be honest, they would say the same thing about some of our views. And that's part of the in-house struggle sometimes we have. So,
Pastor, if I just
go ahead.
Want to say one thing.
Yeah.
To all of us. How can anybody, if you meditate on the actual words and the actual meaning of the words, in the first 6 verses of the book of Acts, deny the kingdom of God, the physical, literal kingdom of God. You cannot read that in the context of the first 6 Acts chapter 1, the first 6 verses. Just read that and meditate when Jesus was saying that and what he said and what he didn't say.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
Not to take the literal view of a literal kingdom of God to come in the future.
Yeah.
Impossible.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's good. All right. Verse 32. Look, it said, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. Who will do that? Well, Antiochus. He will build an allegiance with those who do what? Well, the traitors, the treasonous people. Okay? How will he do it? He will corrupt them or pollute them, it says, with flattery. Flattery is not just words, empty words. Sometimes flattery means bribery. Sometimes it means an offer of positions of power and prestige. You know, that's flattery. It's not just a matter of saying, hey, you look good today. Would you do this for me? Type thing. So he will corrupt them with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. I like that part. The people who know their God. Now, this is in direct reference to a people in this time. Now, we're about 170 BC. This is in direct reference, and we talked about this family last week that we're very familiar with. They are called the Maccabees. If you have a Catholic Bible, there are a couple books in there that have their name upon them. And they will also tell you about the history of this time. Those books will. Okay? Basically, what happened was we have the abomination of desolation. We have the Maccabees and the birthing of the Zealots at this time. But we would call them I'd call them the freedom fighters of that day, who come in after the abomination of desolation and they take back over the temple. Now they're in the temple. They're still under siege. It's not an easy thing. They can't even get out to get the oil to do the proper ceremonial cleansing of the temple. And they have enough oil for one day. Now when you see your Jewish friends start lighting their menorah one each day, they are remembering the defilement of the temple and then the cleansing of the temple and a miraculous act of God to make that one day's worth of oil last for 8 days. So every time they light a candle, they're remembering that day and God's provision. Now, the Jewish people actually established what we would call a late festival in remembrance of this. It's called the Feast of Lights. Luke tells us that Jesus went to the temple and celebrated the Feast of Lights in his ministry. Another word that we use for this is Hanukkah. So when your Jewish friends are celebrating Hanukkah here, I don't know the date of Hanukkah. 2 weeks.
It's an 8-day ceremony, but it happens December 10th this year.
December 10th this year. So when they're celebrating that, that's what they're celebrating. That's Hanukkah to them. That's their, we say that's their Christmas, but it's not really their Christmas, but it happens at the same, about the same time.
Isn't that like the Day of Atonement for them?
No. The Day of Atonement is the Day of Atonement. That has never changed. It's for them, it's wonderfully remembering how God raised up some freedom fighters and how God performed a miracle to make that oil last for all those days when there was only enough for one day. And they believe that it was an act of God so that the temple could be cleansed again. That's what they celebrate.
So this particular thing is referring to the Maccabees?
Yes. Okay. That group that did exploits and stuff. The most famous people we know are the Maccabees. There were others, of course. But the leader of the Maccabees, the one that was the great warrior, his name was Judas Maccabees, which was a common name. Jude or Judas was a common name, particularly at that time. But that's who that was. I was waiting for Mel Gibson. He was going to do one of his epic films on the Maccabees, and then he got goofy and all this kind of stuff, and I was so looking forward to that and stuff, but maybe someday he'll get it done, but I don't know. Huh?
He's still goofy.
I know he's still goofy, but hopefully something will get done. So, yeah. What time we got? Are we done? Oh, we are done. All right, we're going to stop there, verse 32 then, and we'll, I was hoping to get through verse 35, but we didn't, that's fine, but We'll start with verse 33 next week and continue this story. Let me just say, if you want to read ahead, go ahead and read. Verse 36, though, begins for us prophecy. Remember, right now for us, we're still in history. Verse 36 begins prophecy. So basically on that multi-metallic being. We've seen Daniel go from head of gold, arms and breast of silver, the abdomen of bronze. Now we just read where he's about at the place of the legs of iron. And when we go to verse 36, we jump all the way ahead to the feet of iron and clay mix and what's going to happen during that time. Okay? Questions or comments online, anybody? Good to see you. All right, God bless.
Thanks, Pastor.
You bet. Bye-bye. All right, anything else here?